Welcome everyone. Our guest today is Dr. Sara Ahmed, founder of the Living Water Museum in India. Sara, can you tell us about your background and the aims of the Living Water Museum?
Hi, Matteo. Thank you for inviting me to speak here. I've been interested in water issues since I went to school up in the Himalayas in India in a boarding school over there. And I was the only girl in my geography class when I was taken inside a high dam that was being built in a very fragile ecosystem. And we interacted with communities that were going to be displaced by the dam, some of the activist agitations that were going on. Later, I returned to India and did my doctoral research on the cleaning of the Ganga River in Varanasi. And I was very interested in why would people want to participate in cleaning a river that they essentially believed was pure and sacred, and you know, which they had ritual dips and all. So I was very moved by this question, and my work around water has always been as an academic in research around governance and gender and access and policy. But in the last few years, I've been working with artists and looking at how we can use art broadly defined in, to include storytelling, music, performance, and visual art, of course, to communicate on water and to facilitate behavioral change, to facilitate a larger thinking about water values and culture and all. So it was from this background and this perspective that the Living Waters Museum was established in 2017. As a virtual repository to develop stories on India's water heritage, the built heritage, the natural and the cultural heritage around water, and working as a virtual museum, working with young people primarily to build these stories. We call ourselves Living Waters because, as you know, water is so critical to everything, to our human bodies, from birth to death, the whole ritual of life. From agriculture to water security challenges to urbanization, so many things, everything intersects with water, and that's like a living water for us. And the word museum, because to many people, museum is a dead category, especially in South Asia where museums are quite badly maintained. The idea of juxtaposing living to museums was that to me, that word was an organizing category for what we were doing. And at the time when Living Waters Museum was launched in 2017, we also started the Global Network of Water Museums, which was registered out of Venice in Italy.
Okay, thank you very much. So through the work of the Living Waters, you collect narratives and stories that look at water from different lenses to understand maybe the multiplicity of values attached to water. Why do you think it's so important to understand these values?
I think we've grown up in a society where we are increasingly disconnected from water. We open a tap and water comes in most of our homes, not everyone, but at least in terms of our children going to school, etc. They see water in a plastic water bottle or a little AquaGuard system in their house to clean water, or they open a tap and they use water. So we've been disconnected from the system. We see water only flowing through pipelines to our homes. And in the past, in India, at least in the pre-colonial past, there were many systems of water management at the local level, not only around faith-based institutions like temples and mosques and Parsi temples and the, you know, churches and all the faiths use water in different ways. But we lost that connection with water as development, urbanization, growth, etc. started happening. And to me, bringing that value for water back, allowing us to listen to the different water stories that we have in our history and culture, to the voices of indigenous communities, to all sorts of struggles around water. I think that to me is a value system that is missing when we talk about integrated water resource management. And that buzzword around IWRM doesn't look at this local values around water, and particularly the values of those at the margins, the vulnerable societies, the indigenous communities, women. How do they view and how do they see water? What are their stories around water? What is this intergenerational transfer of knowledge around water that we need to keep in mind? So in the past 6 years since we started our work, the museum has a repository of more than 100 stories. And these stories, you know, they have been developed through fellowships, through small grants to young people, through graduate students interning with us, where we are based right now in Pune. Also through collective exhibitions that we've sponsored, which have brought together various kinds of stakeholders, urban planners, conservation architects, people from activist backgrounds, NGOs, educators, students as well, photographers and artists. And since COVID started, we've been looking a lot at urban waterscapes, because I think the challenge for water security is, of course, going to be in our urban areas. We all know that, particularly in India, where urbanization is at this big boom, and we're having not only infrastructure projects for better mobility and communication, but we're also looking at our rivers and waterfronts in ways that are quite mechanical, you know, creating these very beautiful riverfronts and trying to clean up our rivers instead of finding what we would call nature-based solutions, right? So we're doing a lot of this mechanical construction type of work, but not looking at how all this intersects with ecology, with environment, with people, with livelihoods, and so on. So that's what we're trying to do through creating these stories, creating these exhibitions that talk about urban waterscapes from the past to the present, and linking it, of course, to the big question that came out during COVID, which was public health. When I say public health, I don't just mean hand washing, which was the messaging that everyone got. And of course, many people don't even have water for washing hands. So that became a big issue as well. But I think public health more broadly on how these systems and all intersect with water and sanitation and hygiene for us. So that's what we've been working on. And as I said, now we have so many stories and we're trying to take them to schools, to children, to build them into curricula and to have workshops at different physical museums as well, where we can talk about some of these ideas and things and make people think about the water that they're using every day.
Right. So interesting. So I see how your work goes in multiple directions and became valuable for different stakeholders. So it can be translated into capacity building and educational courses, but it can also serve as a starting point to understand how water is at the center of a system that affects and involves so many different actors at different levels of society and supply chains that it really becomes difficult to track them out, every of them. And in this case, the Water Museum can really help in having a clearer and bigger picture of what's happening. Now, maybe you can share a couple of concrete examples, because my interest is also in how do you achieve this? How do you map out this complexity?
Yeah, it is a complex thing. I mean, as I said earlier, we're a virtual museum, but for us, if we cannot just be a website, even as a virtual museum, we have to find ways of engaging. Otherwise, you don't fulfill the function of a museum. And we do that through the classrooms, through conversations, through meetings, through forums, and all of that part of it that happens all the time with the work we're doing. But also in terms of the exhibitions that we were hosting online and when we were building these as collaborative partnerships, we had people who were working on the more technical side, the urban planners, the people in Calcutta associated with the ports, or with things like boat building or whatever. So we've been working with people with diverse backgrounds and hoping that their engagement with other content contributors in creating an exhibition of this size, of this type, makes them also think about what are they taking back to their own workspaces. And I think that's important. I've been teaching foundation studios on water. We have worked with many design schools and architectural colleges in India, where also, you know, studios have been designed for people thinking about water, thinking about sustainable futures, just and equitable and sustainable futures. So that kind of work in terms of capacity building, and I think the training of young minds on water, that is really critical. Because when you look at where does water management in India or in any country that has had a colonial history, Where does it begin from? Usually it's top-down technocentric paradigms on capturing, storing, pumping water, right? All these terms and verbs that you can think about when you think about what we do in terms of controlling our water. But encouraging water managers to think beyond that, to look at how water intersects in our everyday lives through music, through theater, through performance, through art. When I look at pictures of women washing clothes in India, and I have seen my colleagues from Ecuador or from Portugal present similar picture, black and white images of women in their towns and cities, perhaps in the past and some in the present, still washing clothes in public squares with, you know, public standpipes and so forth. And to me, there is that universality of women's water work, and that work and those social spaces that women, for example, have had around water. When you start providing water at home, when you have washing machines and every other luxury in life that all of us want, and which I think everyone is justified to having, but you miss that social space around water. So one of the exhibitions that we've created on our website is about women, water, and work, because we know that the water management world is a very male-dominated world. And I've been doing this for so many years. My colleagues have been doing it, to think about gender and gender sensitization of water managers. How do you build their capacities to look? How do you build their capacities to hear the voices of indigenous communities or those from the lower caste groups in India, the economically backward groups? I think that in India, we still have a lot of issues around caste and, of course, gender and equity and water. But how do you sensitize managers to think about those issues in a way that is non-confrontational? That is important. You don't want to be screeching. People have to empathize, right? And to do that, I think storytelling is a very creative way of doing it. Telling that story, building in the academic and research insights that you want, but doing it in a different mode. So that is something that we've been doing. We've been working with different kinds of storytellers, apart from just visualizers and photographers and artists. An artist that we worked with in Bombay that comes from the Koli community, which is the first indigenous communities that lived in Mumbai. And the work that he does as an artist around dry fish, the dry fish economy, and connecting the voices of people, of the mothers and daughters and daughter-in-laws and their recipes around how to use dry fish and how do you cook with dry fish. And putting that in an artistic format, I wish I could show you his work. But doing that kind of stuff is so important. How do you work with activists that talk about the human right to water, which is something that we know has been so difficult to achieve for the UN, right? So how do you bring in those elements? And I think art allows you to do that. It allows you a platform for communication that makes people think, that is creative, and that, I mean, it's beautiful in its own way. Whether you like art or not, it's in the eye of the beholder or the person hearing it, hearing that piece of music or something. So I think that's important. So that's what we're trying to do. Unfortunately, in India right now, we don't have a physical water museum. That's what I would call a national water museum. We've worked with the government of India. We've worked with the Ministry of Water Resources in 2019 to organize a workshop around creating a national water museum, because India has this huge and beautiful water heritage, and we don't have it anywhere. And unfortunately, when COVID came, all this work just went out because there weren't the funds to support stuff like that. Now, I don't think you need national museums. I think you need more community-based participatory museums where local communities can learn from each other, because that's another thing that water managers don't fully understand, which is that water issues are very contextualized. The case for North India, for what I was talking about earlier, in the Himalayas, which is a fragile environment where you're building large dams and you're taking the water to the plains, to the capital, to Delhi. I mean, not the water, the power, the energy that is generated. And then the issues that you have in South India are so different. So I think creating local repositories that people can learn from each other, very simple things, even along a river, you have upstream and downstream issues and conflict, because downstream people don't really know what's happening upstream. When I spoke last year in the Catskill Mountains in upstate New York at the Watershed Development Corporation, which has a small museum around the story of how New York got its waters from the Hudson River. Okay, for me to go there as an Indian woman and talk about this museum and what we're doing and all, it was an amazing experience. But what was amazing was a little girl who asked me from seeing my photographs, why do women in India carry water on their heads? Who tells them to do that? So how do you explain patriarchy to an 11-year-old girl? So in that sense, being a virtual museum, we are very accessible. We're not a brick and wall and water museum. I can take the museum to New York. I can take it to many places and speak about it in ways that people can understand, a sort of universal language of art. But like I said, it's not enough that we're just a website. We have to do this engagement work. We have to bring these knowledge flows and create that. And also, I want to say that, you know, nowadays everyone talks about digital museums and digital technologies and VR and augmented reality and all of that tech stuff in museums. And I've just come back from Italy where I've seen a museum which has some amazing tech stuff. It's great. But to have a museum which the ordinary woman or man can access on their phone, where they can learn and they can understand, because our content is bilingual in many places, I think that's important. Bringing it down to people to make it accessible. VR and AR and all are fine tools and technologies, but on your phone, it's going to just be very heavy to bring all that in over there. So when we started this as a virtual museum, it was meant to be accessible. It was meant to be innovative. It was meant to take the museum to people and have people come to the museum. It was meant to do all those things. It was meant to create these stories around water, meant to use different media around water. And it started out as an idea that I really didn't even know where it would go. And now it's amazing that very recently we just put together a proposal to take our work in museum making, to share it with partners in Africa and to help facilitate a Blue Nile museum, a digital museum for the Nile countries that we don't often think about, Ethiopia and Sudan and Egypt. And we have a physical museum in Burkina Faso, which is part of the Global Network of Water Museums. And how can we work with that museum also to create stories that can be shared online? Because they do some amazing, very hands-on work with children in their communities, and we can learn from that as well. So as you know, the big meeting that happened in March at the UN in New York, there was a lot of talk about using art as a means of communicating on water. And art, because it's inspirational, because it gets to the emotional well-being of people, and for so many other things. So I think that it was very hard for us to bring in the discourse around water heritage into water management, because there was this kind of, what can we learn from the past? And now it's all about, what can we learn from the past? So I think that even in India, the fact that all these ancient water systems that we had, the tanks, the fountain, the public fountains, the step wells, the amazing underground aqueducts, and all sorts of systems that we've had in the past that became secondary because we had pipelines. Now our focus is back again on these secondary water systems to see how they can be used to provide water security when your pipelines fail. And that is something that we as water museums around the world have been talking about. That it is important that we understand our fluid past, our liquid past, whatever you want to call it. But it is important that we learn from that, because human beings have been adapting for generations. adaptation to climate change is not a new word. It's not a new thing that we invented 20 years ago. But adaptation has been a part of human history since there were human beings. And I think that's important to understand how water systems have evolved and adapted over time. And what is it that we can learn from the past? So that's how we hope that in highlighting these beautiful stories of water heritage across the country, that managers that are responsible for our water systems learn something from this, that they go back and they learn and they interact with many of the stories on our website, have small video clips, they have music, they have voiceovers, they have songs, depends what you're looking, which content you're looking at. And I think that's important to learn from that. You know, just a simple thing like the marine life of a city like Mumbai. I was born there. Even I didn't really know how many marine creatures lived along the shoreline or on the beach up to the intertidal zone. And that diagram there helps us to understand these kind of things. It helps us to look at, okay, you're building this huge, big coastal road project to ease traffic flows in an urban environment. But have you considered that little octopus or that little crab down there or something like that? And I think it's important that we look at the lives of communities. And in fact, I was talking about the artist earlier, Parag Tandal, the fishing communities and the marine life. I mean, that's also when we look at water. I know we're focused largely on fresh water, but we are increasingly being drawn to our coastal and marine environments and how do we look at those as well.
It's very interesting. And I think it's a great example that water managers can take home, the outreaching work, the capacity building, the effort to create capacity building programs, the effort to understand the different narratives and lives that are connected to a water system, to figure it out if this complex system is composed by many different actors, and then how to make this complexity accessible and understandable for everyone. And the fact that the museum is digital is a great example, but perhaps we can think about solutions that can be translated into mediums that become accessible to the people that you are trying to impact with the project you are developing. So I think that there are many, many, many points that are, or at least should be, of inspiration for the creation of resilient water projects. Thank you. Thank you very much, Sarah.
Great. Thank you.